Anyway, some of the worst things that have ever happened to us were things you never actually saw, and in fact, they are things we never actually saw.
Like the sixth game of the 1986 World Series, Shea Stadium. Around the seventh inning, my producer says to me we should probably make our way down to the Boston Red Sox locker room because we want to be in good position and get the post-game celebration of the Red Sox finally winning the World Series. So in the bowels of Shea Stadium, I'm listening to the game via the crowd for about an inning. We get to the ninth, and I walk back towards the Mets locker room, and I see Dick Schaap and his son Jeremy, who's now a reporter for ESPN. He was just a teenager at the time, and I'm asking Jeremy what's going on in the game. He's a Mets fan, a little down on the dumps, giving me the play-by-play as they start the ninth. I start to walk back to the Red Sox locker room, figuring it's going to be over. One out, this is going to be over. 68 years without a World Series victory, it's going to be over. I hear a minor roar, so I run back to Jeremy Schaap. He tells me what happened. I start to walk back to the Red Sox locker room. Another minor roar. I run back to Jeremy Schaap. So he's doing play-by-play for me. I figure I'm going to walk back to the Red Sox locker room one more time. If I hear one more roar, I'm going to get my camera crew and get closer to the Mets locker room. I hear a roar like I've never heard before or since at a sporting event. Jeremy Schaap is heading towards the Mets locker room. My camera crew has just gone into the Red Sox locker room. Now I run into the Red Sox locker room. I never saw Mookie Wilson's ground ball. No clue as to what happened. Their heads were down, long looks on their faces, very emotional scene. Probably 15 writers standing around Bill Buckner's locker. My camera crew is over there already, and I walk up, and nobody was asking Buckner any questions. So I said, "Bill, can you describe what happened?" And he looks up, and if looks could kill, and he says, "You were there, you saw it." Now I've got 15 writers looking at me, waiting for a response. And I couldn't say, "Well, Bill, to be honest with you, I was talking to Dick Schaap's son Jeremy, and I didn't see the play." I went to interview Buckner 7 years later up in Syracuse, where he was working as a hitting instructor for the Blue Jays farm teams. He was great that day. I asked him, "Do you remember me asking you a question right after the game?" And he said, "Yep." "You said, describe what happened." And I'm thinking, that's the dumbest question I've ever heard. "You saw what happened." I told him, "You know, Bill, I never saw that play. I was down right by your locker room waiting to interview you guys right after you won the World Series." And he apologized for that. 7 years later, he apologized for snapping at me. I thought I owed him at least that, of trying to explain why I asked such a dumb question.
Well, I guess it's better that he never really answered that question. I mean, we can say it forever. Calvin Schiraldi pitched like crap. Bob Stanley couldn't grip the ball and kept throwing it away. And John McNamara didn't bother to put Dave Stapleton in at first to save Buck's aching ankles like he'd done every other damn game that season.
Bitter? You're not even a Red Sox fan. And the best part of the trip was getting him to do a fake version of our da-da-da-da-da-da commercials where the Wilson ball actually comes up to him. We cut to a close-up of him fielding it, tagging the bag, and doing the da-da-da-da-da-da, and he loved that.
Very cathartic. Well, how about this one? When I was working in Los Angeles, I got a tip from a perfect source the night before the NFL draft that Rocket Ismail of Notre Dame was going to sign with the CFL Toronto Argonauts, who were then owned by Bruce McNall. Ismail was going to be with McNall at the L.A. Kings game that night at the Forum, and McNall was going to sign him up and then announce it the next morning, right before the draft. So my producer, Ron Grelnick, and I call the station for a camera crew, and the cameraman goes out and waits in his truck in the parking lot, and all through the game, Ron and I are watching the Kings, we're watching Ismail up in McNall's box, and early in the third period, the whole bunch of them get up and leave. And Ron, who conveniently enough used to be an usher at the Forum, goes outside and tries to figure out which exit they're going to use. He recognizes one of the limo drivers. Well, Ismail and his crew and one Argonauts executive are all going to leave via the side door that the indoor soccer team used for its offices. So the cameraman and I hide behind a big transformer in the parking lot, not 15 feet from this door. And I tell him, as soon as I see him, you start recording, turn on your lights, and we'll just ambush him. Well, the game goes into overtime, and it starts raining. And the game goes into double overtime, and the rain gets harder. Finally, I see some activity in this hallway next to this side door. It's Ismail and the executive and three or four other guys, and I turn to the cameraman and I say, "Now!" So he turns on the light, and we rush across the 15 feet, and as the door opens, I start yelling at Ismail, "Rocket, have you signed with the Toronto Argonauts?" And he's stunned. He doesn't say a word, but the look on his face gives it away completely. "How many years is the contract for?" I shout. "3?" And he looks freshly stunned, and he gives that away, too. Now he's going to make a run for the limo. I block him, and I'm thinking, I can block this guy? Why does anybody want to sign this guy? And I ask another question. "Did you get a part ownership of the team as part of this contract you signed tonight?" And his look gives it away again. Finally, the Argos executive grabs Ismail by the arm and just pulls him in, the deer frozen in the headlights, away from me. and they all pile into the limo. And my cameraman drops to one knee at the same moment. He starts shooting into the limo where Ismail and the executive are sitting side by side. And I yell at the exec, "Is that a rocket in your pocket, or are you just glad to see us?" They slam the door shut, the driver hits the gas, and they screech out of sight. Ron and I are jumping around and talking about how the other networks are going to run this tape the next day and will be quoted in the newspapers and the whole silly, giddy, adrenaline-high stuff. And then the cameraman says, "Hold on," and we freeze.
Oh, no.
He says five simple, tragic words. "I never rolled the tape." The perfect story. The stakeout that pays off for the 100 stakeouts that don't. And he forgot to press the record button.
Good thing one of my cameramen forgot to roll. When I was working in Dayton, we would drive a good hour and a half to get to Riverfront Stadium. So we would get there early. And the first time I went to a Bengals game, I had a lot of time to kill. So I'm walking around the stadium, just kind of seeing where everything is. And I turn a corner and walk right into where the Bengals cheerleaders are getting dressed. Let's put it this way. They weren't exactly finished getting dressed. I hear a few shrieks, and I felt bad that I just walked in on them. Well, sort of bad. I went back and told my cameraman there was this room where they had some free sandwiches. I never did apologize to him for doing that, so I'd like to do that now. So far, everything has been our fault. I think it's only fair we start sharing the blame, sharing the experience, sharing the memories.
Sharing the blame. Things happen at least once a night. They seem to be inevitable.
Perhaps the worst is the dreaded missing page.
A short highlight can be described on a one-page shot sheet. Most of them take 2 pages, some take 3. Well, one night, the Texas Rangers are playing the Tigers in Detroit, and I get a 3-pager. I'm going along, and I finish page 1, and I go to page 2, and I notice in the upper corner it reads, page 3. And there's no other page. Now, there's a way you can cheat when that happens, if it's baseball. You can listen carefully to the background noise playing on the tape itself, and the recorded play-by-play will at least give you a clue or something to go on. Not this time. It was a succession of walks. Not homers, not strikeouts. Walks. And the announcers on the tape were dead silent. I swear I heard crickets on that tape. And this is 1994, when the Rangers had several guys who all looked exactly the same. Jeff Fry, David Hulse, Rusty Greer, Doug Strange, and damn if they all weren't playing in this game. So all I could think to say was, "And there's a walk to a small white guy on the Rangers. And there's another walk to another small white guy on the Rangers." Dan's trying to help. He's whispering, "I think that's David Hulse. No, that's David Hulse." It was horrible.
They did all look the same. This stuff doesn't happen all the time. And when it does, it's usually nowhere near this bad. Once a year is enough to scar you for life, though.
Sometimes what happens is just strange. Here's a few of the weirdest things we've heard said by athletes.
"I looked at the bitch, and I said, 'You're it.'" This is from Mrs. Bernard Freeman of the 1989 Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show judge after choosing the Doberman Royal Tudor's Wild as the Wind as best in show. This frail, elderly woman had been asked if the winner, as apparently so often happens in the world of dogdom, had looked at the judge and told her, "I'm it." Of course, it sounds more like something you would hear from Mike Tyson.
"I looked at the bitch and I said, 'You're it.'"
Mike Tyson, in 1996, he said, "I'm always going to survive. Only reason I can't survive is if I'm dead or something." Can't really argue with him, can we?
Mm-mm. After a Winnipeg Jets-New York Rangers game in 1979, Bobby Hall said to Keith, "Never mind the past. We're here in the future now."
There's something spooky and time-travel-y about this. "Coach told me to be amphibious." That was Charles Shackelford while at NC State, explaining why he had shot with either hand during a game.
"I know your work. I don't respect it, but I know it." That's from a New York public relations man to Keith in 1983. I think the feeling was mutual.
You are correct, sir. Then there's George Brett being questioned about his attack of hemorrhoids during the 1980 World Series. "Just because you guys are perfect assholes, I don't know why you're making such a big deal about this. My problems are all behind me." It was a shock when I realized people actually watched our show. They know who we are. We're well known.
We're sitting in Keith's dining room going over this stuff, and every once in a while, we'd remember something that happened, even 4 and 5 years ago, and then we would just stare, and then laugh, and then find ourselves not believing that it actually happened.
And to that point, I'm most impressed by the ongoing relationship you have with Bill Murray.
I still can't describe it. He is a diehard sports fan.
But this is a guy we saw in our formative drunken college years on Saturday Night Live in Caddyshack. This is a Carl Spackler here telling us we're almost cool. Where does this Murray thing come from?
Actually, the Sunday Conversation. He showed up 45 minutes late, and he was very funny. He was on that day. And we started to do the interview, but I could never get an honest, straight answer out of Bill. He couldn't get focused. He kept blowing everything off. When I would throw a question out, he would change the subject. He was out of control. He was just goofy. Finally, just to get him quiet, I gave him a putter, and he was putting this golf ball around while we were doing the conversation. It was the only time I could get him to give me straight answers. And since then, he calls. All times, all days, strange times, strange questions, he leaves messages.
And he holds your hand.
You know, it's not like I planned that hand-holding thing with Bill. Can I explain it?
Your wife and children and America are waiting for the answer.
All right, at the ESPYs in 1996, we conned Bill into being on stage one more time. He said he'd do it if I went on with him. So we get up there for rehearsal. Guess who doesn't show up? Bill. Finally, a half hour before Keith and I are supposed to go on the air with the quote-unquote pregame show, I get the call. Bill's arrived. Drop everything. He doesn't know what's going on when he goes out on stage. He doesn't even want to talk about what we're going to do out there. He wants to talk about everything else. So finally, I say to him, Bill, you know, we're going to be interviewing Michael Jordan live, and we have to give him the Comeback Player of the Year award, and we kind of have to script this, okay? Bill's answer is, yeah. Let's go get something to drink. So we're getting something to drink, and I say, you know, I'm not sure what we're going to do up there. He says, well, don't worry about it. We'll figure it out. I'll let you know. This is literally 5 minutes before we're going on live TV. Bill, just clue me in on what you want to ask Michael. He says, come on, let's take a walk. So we walk and we walk and we walk. About 200 feet from the stage, he pushes open this door. I see this plume of smoke coming out, and we're in David Letterman's dressing room. I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm a huge Letterman fan. I'm also going to be on stage with Bill Murray and Michael Jordan in 3 minutes. I have no idea what we're going to do. And Bill takes this opportunity to have me meet Letterman.
Not later. Not after your bit. Right then.
Right then. And Bill says, David, this is Dan Patrick. And Letterman goes, Dan, big fan. Bill, you know this thing about golf. Why do I have to count my putts? I mean, it took me that long to get to the green. Why do I have to putt? I mean, I shot a 135. Dan, what's ESPN3? Is that like live televised random drug testing? So all of a sudden, I'm the straight man in a Bill Murray, David Letterman routine. And I say to Dave, no, it's not. Bill, the song is ending. We're going to be on. What are we doing with Michael Jordan? Bill looks at Dave and just shrugs. Bill and I walk onto the stage. Actually, it was a quick trot. As we're being introduced, Bill says, I'm going to grab your hand. Follow along.
Oh, I get it now. Bill wasn't doing anything with Michael Jordan. You were.
This is what is dawning on me as we walk onto the stage at Radio City Music Hall. Bill Murray is grabbing my hand. And we get through it somehow, though Bill does ask Michael if he thinks it's fair that he got the comeback award when Monica Seles got stabbed and she didn't win it. We walk off stage and Bill says, now you know what it's like to be on Saturday Night Live. And he got the biggest kick because he loved doing it that way. He loved putting me through it.
Which is the theme, really, of all of our brushes with the genuine celebrities out there. They want me to coach first base against the Minnesota Twins in an exhibition game because they want to see me get hit by a line drive. They want me to coach the Connecticut women's basketball team in a scrimmage because they want to see how funny I look in a suit on a bench.
I'm still amazed that anybody even asked for an autograph, or when they asked for that autograph. I'm at the Super Bowl 3 years ago, and at halftime I go into the men's room, and the guy standing next to me looks over, looks away. Looks over, looks away.
Where are you going with this? Do I really want to hear this, Dan?
Well, relax. We're both doing what you're supposed to be doing in a urinal. And finally, this guy says to me, hey, you're one of them Sports Center dudes, aren't you? Well, then he turns to me, still doing what you're supposed to be doing in a urinal, and says, da-da-da.
Did you give him an autograph?
No, he nearly gave me his, if you know what I mean.
Rimshot, please.
The other time was when my first daughter was born. There was a doctor, two nurses, and an intern in the room, and the intern had been dying to talk sports with me, but he really couldn't find the opportune time when you're going to be talking about, say, the New England Patriots in between contractions. Finally, the doctor says to my wife, you can start pushing now, your baby's ready to be born. So my wife is getting ready to deliver my daughter, and now this intern leans over to me, and he whispers, da-da-da, da-da-da, I guess this is your SportsCenter moment. Fortunately, my wife didn't hear him. I would have hated to have read the headline the next day, Wife of SportsCenter Anchor Gives Birth, Then Kills Intern.
I have no story like that, sad to say. As Hawkeye Pierce once said, I'm still my only child. But this stuff outside of the sports world is silly enough, but the things that the ball players themselves do to us is just amazing.
You don't get this stuff at games. I get to go out and cover stuff a little bit more often, and they just don't want to talk sometimes. They want to make me perform, like Dan Marley when he was with the Suns.
And here I must point out that my tag team partner firmly believes that were it not for his knees, he would have been one of the greatest athletes of all time, inducted to the Basketball Hall of Fame unanimously.
Thank you. Thank
me,
you.
Me, I played catch with Joe McGrane in spring training one year, and he had the human decency not to tell anybody that I throw like a girl, and that's as close as I'm ever going to get. You think you're going to stop by the Seattle Supersonic shoot-around one day and get signed to a 10-day contract.
That'll happen. So, early in the 1992-93 season, I had gone to see a Sun-Celtics game in Hartford, and Dan Marley came over beforehand and asked if I wanted to come out and shoot. He and Cedric Sabalos and I shot three-pointers. Marley beat me, I beat Sabalos, so I kept saying, I need a rematch. 8 months later, at the NBA Finals, the Suns are ready to get started practicing, and Marley's been taking money from all of his teammates in three-point shooting contests. I'm in a suit and tie, dress shoes, and Marley says, do you want a piece of me now? In front of everybody on the team. In front of Dr. Jack Ramsey, who was our ESPN analyst. Now Jack says, go ahead, Dan. And I say, well, I've got my suit and tie on, Dr. Jack. And Jack says, well, Dan, great shooters can shoot no matter what they have on. Then Paul Westfall, Phoenix's coach at the time, says he'll hold up practice and the whole team will watch.
You are out of options here, Dan.
Yes, I'm backed into a corner. No choice. I give Dr. Jack my coat, I loose my tie, and Marley offers to let me go first. I tell him, no, you go first. So Marley makes 8 out of 15 three-pointers. My turn. I make 7 out of 14. So before the 15th, he says, if you make it, you tie, and nobody cares. If you bank it, it counts as 2, you win. What's your decision?
Now, to be fair, you didn't have anything to lose at this point. I mean, you had already hit 7, so even if you lost now, you lost by one basket to one of the top professionals, and anyway, you have these horrible, crippling knee injuries. You have an age factor, a comparatively out-of-shape factor, a shirt and tie factor, an amateur versus the pro factor. I mean, you have already won this.
Why don't you deflate my balloon a little bit? You see through all of this, I know. Marley didn't at the time, and I didn't want to tie Marley, but you're right, nothing to lose, and I banked it in. And Charles Barkley erupts, gets right in Marley's face and says it's the greatest thing he's ever seen. And I'll always have this on Dan Marley. Marley called it the most devastating moment of his career.
Now, don't forget the punchline on the Marley story.
Oh, yeah, the next night, Marley goes out and sets an NBA record in the finals with 8 three-pointers.
Advantage, Dan. Well, I give up. You've gotten to do more neat stuff than I did. But I ruined your big homecoming. Remember Midnight Madness at Dayton?
We're kicking off the Dayton Flyers season. And I'm the guest MC. I'm figuring, I'm back home. Love me, fans. Love me. And as soon as I get out there, 5,000 people in the stands suddenly hold up Keith Olbermann mask right in front of their faces. And I was dumbfounded when I saw it. He got me again.
It's not like you're not always ready to seek revenge or something. Eric Lindros at the ESPYs,
mm-hmm.
You set me up to have my flipping brains beaten in.
I'm out there at the games more than you are. I've taken the heat for you. I've taken the fall for you. So I see John LeClair and Eric Lindros of the Flyers standing at the bar after the ESPYs, and LeClair says, hey, the guy you work with is just beating up on my boy.
He had missed a bunch of games with some nagging injuries, and we had a shot of him looking at his hand, and I said, Eric Lindros examines the hangnail that'll probably keep him out for 3 weeks. And when he finally did play 2 consecutive games, I said, Lindros is now just 2,128 games behind Lou Gehrig's streak.
Yeah, I wonder why he was upset about that.
I don't know.
So I say to Lindros, you want to get back at him? Go up to him and say, look, you say anything else about my injuries and I'll kick your ass. Next thing I know, you two are arm in arm leaving the party to go to some after-hours club. So I can't win.
Well, I went over to the bar to say hi to Gino Auriemma, the UConn basketball coach for the women. And Lindros looks at me and he raises his hand and he says, look, Keith, no hangnails. And I laugh like hell, and he laughs, and the next thing I know, he's buying me a beair. And then he goes to the bathroom, and then LeClair grabs me by the arm, and he says, your partner was over here trying to get Eric to take a shot at you. So we told him we would. But Eric's not mad at you, and I'm sure as hell not. Hell, I should be saying thank you. He really didn't know the difference between injuries that hurt that you play through and injuries that can get worse if you continue to play. He saw what you said about him, and he started thinking he was getting a reputation for being soft. So thanks. You're an honorary member of the Legion of Doom.
Damn.
No, Doom. Well, Lindros comes back, and we were just hitting it off, and we kept talking and talking, and eventually he and LeClaire and Dan Quinn of the Flyers take me to this bar in their limo, and Lindros can't stop talking about what a hero Mark Messier of the Rangers is to him. So who's the first person we see when we get to this place? Messier.
And you have made certain unkind comments about Mr. Messier's hair, or lack thereof.
What it is I have suggested his hair is close-cropped. I once had a shot of him holding the President's Trophy, and I said he just won the award for having the closest cropped hair in the NHL. Anyway, Lindros takes me over to him, and he bows, and he calls him Jesus, and he begins to introduce me, and Messier interrupts him. Oh, I know this guy. And he raises his hand, and now I know I'm going to get clocked. And instead, he rubs his hand across his head, and he says, close cropped, eh? What it is I'm bald is what it is. And I start to apologize, and he laughs, and he has this classic head-tilting all-the-way-back laugh, and he says, close-cropped is a compliment.
I can't believe it. I am outraged.
So the evening wears on, and of course hockey players are the most convivial people in the world. Lindros hands me a beer. Messier hands me a beer. Quinn hands me a beer. And now it's pushing 4 in the morning, and these guys have practice in 7 hours in Philadelphia, and LeClaire starts rounding them up for the ride home. And Lindros begins to shout about how happy he is that he won the Hockey ESPY.
The guy wins the Hart Trophy as MVP at age 22, and he's excited about winning the ESPY.
Exactly. So he starts to stand up, and he's a little unsteady, and he knocks over his own chair as he stands up. And now he starts to get up on the table to dance, and LeClaire shouts at him, what are you doing, you big baboon? That'll never hold your weight, you tub of lard. And Lindros stops, and he says, oh, Johnny, what am I thinking? I've had one too many tonight. Let's get the hell home. And he walks over to me, and he gives me a hug, and LeClaire gives me a hug, and now I'm figuring I've got 4 broken ribs.
Hugs from hockey players. And the point of telling this love fest is what, exactly?
The point is, 2 days later, on the gossip page of the New York Post, there's a picture of Lindros, and a story that reads as follows. To the horrors of revelers, including Tim Robbins, Mark Messier, and Herbie Hancock, Lindros started kicking around chairs, and eventually jumped up on top of a table for a victory dance. When the stogie-chomping skater refused to get down, security escorted him to the big penalty box outside. Unquote. Well, Tim Robbins left right after we got there. If Herbie Hancock was there, he was invisible. Messier stayed an hour after all the Flyer guys left. And I saw Lindros start to get up on a table and then realize how stupid it was, and he left of his own accord. I thought of all the stories we see that are simply distortions of what happened. And I swear I have never read one on the air since in which I presumed that the athlete was in the wrong. And I thought it is very nice to be famous, sort of, part-time.
Amen.
Every American realizes at some date that he or she is not going to become or not going to remain a professional athlete. I figured it out at age 8 after one beanball and one good look at the softball immortal Eddie Fainer striking out every one of my teachers. Dan?
I had a pretty good idea when I was 12. I knew it for certain at 19, about the same time I discovered I could make a sound like popping popcorn with my knee.
There does not appear to be a similar moment of epiphany about the subject of becoming a sports broadcaster, though. The job, from a distance, looks ideal. A paid vacation of sorts. Watching sports, going to games, meeting players, getting lots of money, getting fame.
Did you ever see the Tank McNamara comic strip? One storyline was of Tank's brother-in-law getting a job watching and logging games for an all-sports network. He couldn't wait for the job to begin. A week after being forced to watch games, sometimes at 3:17 in the morning on Christmas morning, after a week of that, he was begging to go back to plumbing or cement work or whatever.
As an analogy, let's say you like ice cream. Can you imagine being paid to eat it for a living? Great! Every day? All day? And not just butter pecan, but also that new experimental spinach salsa crunch.
Trust you to come up with the food references.
Thank you.
And to make it where we did in our careers, there were uncountable breaks and circumstances without which somebody else would be writing this book. Moreover, there were men and women as talented, as driven, often more so, who didn't get those breaks or didn't stay in the industry for whatever reason. The big show is also hardly representative of the industry as a whole, Keith.
I broke in at United Press International's radio network a month after I graduated from Cornell in 1979. My starting salary was $8,870. I would take $1.50 and buy 2 Subway tokens to go out to either Yankee or Shea Stadium or Madison Square Garden, because the free meal and the free entertainment allowed me to save about $2 off the price of dinner at Burger King. The one overriding thought in my mind at that time was, I still had it easy. Somewhere. Somewhere there was an equally talented guy working some horrible shift in some horrible place with absolutely no hope of getting anywhere unless something extraordinary happened. And sure enough, that guy, of course, happened to be Dan.
Months after getting my college degree, I finally found employment running the religious tapes on a rock and roll radio station. I'd get there about 2 in the morning on Sunday. Till 9, I just sat there making sure the tape didn't break, and the revealed word kept being revealed to the 5 listeners whose dials happened to be on our radio station. For 6 months, my entire on-air career consisted of saying, "You're listening to WTUE, Dayton's best rock and roll." So one blessed Sunday morning, as Dayton's best rock and roll station belted out the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, my boss tripped over me and asked if I'd ever done the news before. I said yes. I was lying. And boy, did I ever pay for it. They put me on doing the morning drive newscast. And the first name I ever had to pronounce in morning drive was the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Yeah.
I turned it into something that sounded like the lyrics to that annoying Macarena song, Ayayayatollah Khomeini.
This, at about the same time, I was announcing on UPI that USC had beaten Southern Cal. See, on the surface, these grinds were different, but at the core, it really was the same. Bad hours, learn as you go, hope the boss didn't hear the big mistake, just enough money to know that you were just short of what you really needed, and allow yourself the opportunity to take advantage of the Wally Pipp rule.
Put yourself in a position to be there when fate gives you your one and possibly only big break. This is the Wally Pipp rule. Anyone who doesn't know who Wally Pipp is and was can forget about becoming a sportscaster. Mine came in 3 parts. You've already suffered through the Ayatollah Khomeini radio newscast part. Part 2 came when, after 4 years in radio in Dayton, I made a videotape with my friend's camera. I showed it to all the TV stations in town, and nobody would touch it. Finally, just to get it off his back, the news director at Channel 2 in Dayton said, "I don't know why you would want to do this, but I'll let you work as an odds job guy in the sports department." I took it. After months of doing this, the backup sportscaster, Ken Kettering, had to take the weekend off because his wife was about to give birth to their 4th child. So somebody had to fill in. They pointed at me. So I took my one suit and filled in. The news director liked what he saw and made me the field reporter. Later that same year, I took some vacation to visit friends in Atlanta. And on the last day I was there, on a whim, took a video cassette of my best TV work and walked in to the CNN offices. The receptionist told me, "Just leave the tape at the desk and we'll get back to you." I explained I was leaving for home the next day, and I just wanted to know what somebody thought of my tape. The receptionist actually phoned the sports department to get somebody to come and get this guy off her hands, and out came the company's vice president for sports, Bill McPhail. While trying to shoo me out the door, McPhail learned I was from Ohio. He grew up outside of Columbus. "Gee," he says, "what do you think State's going to do this year? How do the Buckeyes look?" "What? Well, come on in. Let's look at the tape. What's your name again?" They hired me that same day to work at CNN Headline News.
Now, if Dan hadn't fibbed about his vast news background, and if the Ketterings had quit at 3 kids, and if Bill McPhail had been from Columbus, Georgia, Dan might now be the dean of Dayton Radio, collecting tapes for his 20th anniversary newscast. My big break also came in 3 parts. Because the 4th of July fell on a Wednesday in 1979, it basically wiped out the whole week at most business offices. So when one of UPI's sportscasters gave his 2 weeks' notice on Monday, July 2nd, the bosses had no time to look for a veteran guy who'd have to give his own 2 weeks' notice or to move somewhere. They needed somebody within 5 or 6 business days. Well, guess who? A year later, I was still working at UPI when a local New York radio station, the fabled WNEW-FM, began running the commentaries that I did for the radio network. They ran them at 4:30 a.m., and once I came in to do the commentary live for them. About half an hour after that, I was sitting around the newsroom shared by the AM and the FM stations when the AM station's news director, Sam Hall, walked in. And Hall said, "Hey, you're what's-his-name? You're Obergefell, right?" And I said, "Yep, whatever you say. Nice to meet you, Mr. Hall." And he said, "You do sports, right?" And I said, "That's right, Mr. Hall." And he said, "My sports guy, John Kennelly, he just called in sick. Would you like to make some per diem and fill in for him this morning?" Well, I went on in 3 minutes. That led to a job filling in for about 6 weeks a year on one of the biggest radio stations in New York. Now, that fill-in gig led to one of the biggest TV sports critics in New York, Stan Isaacs from Newsday, taking an interest in my work. A year later, Isaacs wrote a glowing column about my, quote, funny, unquote, radio sportscasts. In those days, only one of Isaacs' several columns per week was reprinted in the national edition of the Sunday Washington Post, the one that was delivered only to displaced Washingtonians in other cities. Well, at his breakfast nook in suburban Atlanta, Rick Davis, displaced Washingtonian and Bill McPhail's number two man at CNN Sports, was thumbing through his Post, mumbling to himself as usual about how he needed to find somebody, quote, funny, unquote, to liven up his sportscasts, and he stumbled upon Isaac's column. And the column that had been chosen for the Post that week happened to be the one about me. And, of course, this whole thing gets even more tenuous. Bill McPhail just happened to be trying to fill out his sports staff for the new CNN venture called Headline News, and he just happened to be heading to New York to see his brother who lived there, so he just happened to be able to interview me. And even when I was making too much money in radio in New York to consider his initial offer, he just happened to need somebody to fill in for his New York bureau sports reporter who just happened to be taking 2 weeks vacation. That is a lot of just happens. No Wednesday, 4th of July means no visit to the WNEW newsroom at 4:30 in the morning, means no Isaacs column, means nobody at the Post choosing the one about me, means Davis keeps turning his pages, and I never get on TV.
We have a list of free pieces of advice to other sportscasters.
Stop saying, "Hi, everybody!" Most people still listen to radio or watch TV by themselves. Subconsciously, when you say, "Hi, everybody!" to one guy sitting in a room alone, he thinks you're talking to everybody else.
Never do an infomercial. Your career is over. You're done. Toast, fried. We don't care if you're selling salad dressing that gives eternal life. You will never be taken seriously again.
Don't say, "Welcome back." The viewer didn't go anywhere. You did.
If a player has a slipped, bulging, or herniated disc and you've had an alcoholic beverage any time in the preceding 96 hours, please, please, just say back injury.
Never read the name of a sponsor of an event or a stadium unless there is a gun pointed at your head. Just because they call it the Your Name Here Open does not mean you have to.
Avoid the overly specific synonym for beat. Years after the tragic campus shootings at Kent State University, one sportscaster announced that Colorado buffaloed Colorado State, Harvard outsmarted Yale, and the Air Force shot down Kent State.
Finally, as Warner Wolf long ago pointed out, whatever they call it, since a ball hitting it is a fair ball, that thing sticking up in either corner of a baseball outfield logically has to be the fair pole.
Thank you. Thank you. Hey, let's liven things up. Let's talk about Pete Rose.
Here we go again. He may be a dishonored baseball great, but he's your dishonored baseball great, right, Dan?
Yes, he is. I view Pete Rose like a graduate student who got caught cheating.
No, that was Ted Kennedy. Sorry, I'm interrupting. Climb as far out onto that limb as you care to. I have got the saw already, fella.
Keith, Pete Rose was accused of betting on baseball while he was managing the Cincinnati Reds. That cannot delete what he did as a ball player.
Hold on there, Bunky. We know Pete was in financial trouble dating back to the 70s, and there is ample evidence that his baseball betting stuff had begun long before he was just the skipper of the Reds. You are just a Cincinnati fan looking for something, anything, to obliterate the fact that Pete Rose was banned from baseball. And until and unless he is reinstated, you can't put him in the Hall of Fame.
It still comes back to Pete Rose, the ball player. He's been punished. His image has been stained. It would be nice to let him restore a little bit of dignity. Put him in the Hall of Fame, and you'll probably never hear from him again.
You're saying, give him the honor he doesn't currently deserve, and then he'll be a good boy, and he'll not rock the boat, and then it'll look like he deserves the honor.
Mm-mm.
This is not shoeless Joe Jackson, who confessed that he took money as part of a scheme to lose the 1919 World Series, ironically enough to your Reds, and then said it was wrong, and he tried to repent, and was still thrown out in the middle of his career.
Wait a minute. Joe Jackson fixed games. There's no evidence Rose tried to fix games. None. Betting? Yes. Betting on the Reds? Maybe, but only to win.
What do you call it when the same guy who decides whether or not to bring in his best reliever or his worst reliever has already decided whether or not to bet that his team is going to win that game? That's fixing. That's passive-aggressive fixing. I'll save so-and-so for tomorrow and lay an extra five large on our team. Only the nature of the result differs.
I think we're dealing with semantics. We're not going to agree on this, are we?
I'll bet we don't.
I suppose you want to move on to your annual Hall of Fame complaints.
May I?
Can I stop you?
No. It should be remembered first at all times when dealing with the Baseball Hall of Fame that no matter who has picked the members, the honor or the pressure of making these choices has made morons of them all. We should consider ourselves lucky that Babe Ruth is in the hall and Ruth Buzzy isn't. They simply do not know what the frig they're doing.
All right, while we're on this topic, then, you have to tell the courtesy vote story.
With relish. Rick Ferrell was a pretty good catcher from 1929 through 1947. Pretty good farm system director, general manager for Detroit, and by all accounts, a pretty good guy. Rick played 18 years. Admittedly, in eight of these, he did not catch 100 games in a single season. He hit .281 lifetime. He hit 28 career homers. His brother, Wes Ferrell, had hit .280 lifetime with 38 homers. Of course, Wes was a pitcher. Reporters covering the Committee on Veterans would tell tales every year of how its members would cast courtesy votes for old buddies, knowing full well that these guys would never actually get elected. Everybody was happy. Nobody got hurt. And then in 1984, it happened. Apparently, everybody on the committee cast his courtesy vote for Rick Ferrell. Bingo! He's a Hall of Famer!
Amazing.
I always used to be real prissy about the Hall of Fame, select group and all that. Now I say if you can reasonably argue that a guy is a Hall of Famer, then why not? Put them all in.
And have a separate tier for the true immortals, like the top 20 or so. Ruth, Aaron, Cy Young, Pete Rose.
All right, so I've got this list of guys who should be considered for the Hall long before we have to start letting in the unrehabilitated, whether it's Rose or Sonny Jackson, the shortstop who received a vote after hitting less than .240 in five full seasons, or Buck Weaver.
Wait a minute, how long is the list?
Exactly 100 guys.
I'll give you 10.
20?
10.
All right, I'll pick out some highlights or something. 15. All right, here they are alphabetically. Number one, Bill Buckner. Did you know that the dividing line at Cooperstown for base hits is 2,763? Every eligible ball player who ever got 2,763 hits is already in there. All the as-yet-ineligibles will be.
Except Pete Rose.
Well, till we hear otherwise, he is permanently ineligible. My point here is that the line exists. You're one of the 37 guys who's gotten 2,763 hits. You're in, or you will be. And after that, it's catch as catch can. Bill Buckner retired just 48 hits short of that magic number. And considering the fact that he screwed up his ankle in 1975, I think he did pretty damn good for himself. He played 18 full seasons between 1971 and 1988, and during them, only Rose got more base hits than Billy Buck did. Considering what he is remembered for, and that was John McNamara's mistake and not his, he was not just a fine first baseman, he was an influential first baseman. He made Wade Boggs and Marty Barrett into quality big league infielders. He helped put the Red Sox into the World Series in 1986. Number two on this list, Lou Burdett. Dan and I had this mind-bending discussion after Greg Maddux went 19-2 in 1995. You remember?
Yeah, I remember. I asked you if you thought that if Greg Maddux of the year 2025 came back in time and told the Greg Maddux of 1995 that he had done all he was going to do, that he would never win another Cy Young Award, and maybe he'd be hurt, and maybe he'd be a 500 pitcher the rest of his life, should the Greg Maddux of 1995 simply retire and get into the Hall of Fame based only on what he had just done?
And my answer was?
You said Lou Burdett.
Thank you. At the end of the 1961 season, Lou Burdett was almost as good a bet for the Hall of Fame as Greg Maddux was at the end of the 1995 season. In his era to that point, only four pitchers had better ERAs. He was 163 and 106 lifetime, winning percentage .606, and he had won at least 17 games for each of the preceding six seasons. The problem was, for the remaining 6 years of his career, he was a journeyman, a 500 pitcher. He ended up with 203 wins and only 144 losses, but it was not the same.
Yeah, but he threw a spitter, didn't he?
And Burdett has never been seriously considered because of it. But Burley Grimes and Red Faber and Ed Walsh are all in the Hall of Fame, and they all threw spitballs when it was legal to do that. And we're holding it against Burdett because he pitched in a time when it wasn't. Number three, Dom DiMaggio. Had everything his brother had except the power. He missed three seasons due to the war. He had to quit due to injuries at age 36. And he was still third in his era in runs scored, sixth in doubles, second to Stan Musial in batting average for anybody who came up at least 5,637 times during that span. Your mileage may vary. This is the classic guy who should go in the very politically correct career shortened by circumstances theory. He got 1,679 hits in 10 full seasons. Johnny Pesky told me in spring training in 1996 that his old teammate would be in the Hall of Fame if his name had been Dom Smith.
The same Johnny Pesky who gave you a soul handshake in the spring of 96?
Right on. All right, number four, Larry Doby. Probably lost five seasons between the war and the color line. He was still 10th in his time in home runs. Twice he led the American League in homers. Five times he drove in more than 100 runs. And he fought the same battles that Jackie Robinson fought. He broke in with Cleveland just 3 months after Robinson started with Brooklyn. The guy had a lifetime slugging percentage of .490, and he managed the White Sox in 1978, when the Al Campanis view of black skippers was probably still held by about 75% of the baseball hierarchy. It is criminal that he's not in there. All right, number five of our 15, Curt Flood.
You like iconoclasts, don't you?
I would like to see Curt Flood, Charles O'Finley, Bowie Kuhn, and Marvin Miller go in the same year.
How about an iconoclast wing in Cooperstown?
How about a wing for guys who sacrificed? Who is more deserving than Flood? First guy I would vote for. A few months before his 32nd birthday, with 12 wonderful seasons behind him as the brilliant center fielder of the St. Louis Cardinals, Curt Flood was traded to the doormats of the National League, the Phillies, and he said, no. He said, you do not have the right to ship my butt anywhere you please, not after I've given you a dozen years of my life. And he stood up against the establishment, and whatever you think the players have done to the game in the last 25 years, what the owners had done to the players for the previous 100 years was a million times worse. And Curt Flood refused to go, and he sued, and it cost him his career. This wasn't some fringe guy. Through 1969, he had 1,854 hits. All he needed was seven more average seasons to get to 3,000. He had batted .293 for his career. Only six guys outdid him in his era, and five of them are in the Hall of Fame. He had won seven straight gold gloves. He'd been on three pennant winners, two world champs. The man got exactly 35 more at-bats in his life. He even lost the lawsuit. But he paved the way for the freedoms and the salaries and the rewards that those who followed enjoyed to this day. As Bob Gibson wrote, every Major League Baseball player should give 1% of their salary to Curt Flood. Well, now he passed away, and it's too late to see that. The least he deserves, a plaque in Cooperstown. He was 32. He gave it all up for a principle. Moving on. Number six, Jack Glasscock. We simply diss this guy.
Wait a minute. Jack Glasscock. Let me get childish here. No relation to Dick Trickle, right?
The name alone would increase attendance at Cooperstown. All right, 17-year shortstop star whose career ended in 1895. Defensively brilliant before gloves were standard. .290 hitter when you were lucky to hit .260. Fourth in his era. Also third in base hits. Ninth in runs scored. He made 2,040 hits, even though he broke in when the National League was still playing an 85-game schedule. That means he averaged 1.18 hits per game. Your pal Petey averaged 1.20 hits per game, so there. Number seven, Tommy John. This, to me, is one of the great no-brainers of all time. Wins 288 games, fourth best all-time for Southpaws. Pitches on four pennant winners, two more division winners, comes back from the kind of arm injury that ended the career of every pitcher before him, wins 20 games three times after the surgery, goes 13-6 at the age of 44, and he ends up with a better ERA than Fergie Jenkins. And he's not in the Hall. Number eight, as Bill James pointed out, Jim Cott and Robin Roberts basically ended up with the same numbers. Roberts was 286 and 245. Cott was 283 and 237. Roberts had 2,357 strikeouts, 902 walks, in 4,689 innings. Cott had 2,461 strikeouts, 1,083 walks, in 4,529 innings. Roberts' ERA, 3.41. Cott's ERA, 3.45. Roberts was spectacular for 6 years and then a mediocre pitcher the rest of his career. Cott won 25 games in 66 and then 21 and 20, 8 and 9 years later. He was in double figures in wins every season from 1962 to 1976, and then he had a respectable second career as a middle reliever. And Jim was a left-hander, pitching most of his career in a park noted for favoring right-hand bats. Oh, and there's that small matter of the 16 consecutive gold gloves. Jim Cott for the Hall of Fame. And he's also fifth place all-time in wins by left-handers. So it's him, it's Tommy John, it's Burt Blyleven with 287 wins and third in strikeouts all-time, and it's Don Sutton with 324 victories. They all are not in. This is the what-are-you-kidding-me department.